Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with information emerging that Israel has weaponized artificial intelligence and AI tools are being used in Gaza for targeted assassination, with the Gospel system used to target buildings used by militants, Lavender used to compile kill lists, and Where's Daddy to track combatants to their homes before killing them there. Joining us is Dr. Nancy O'Kale, President and CEO of the Center for International Policy. A scholar and advocate of human rights, justice, peace, and equity, she has over 20 years of experience working on these issues across the Middle East and North Africa region, as well as globally. And she provides policy recommendations to senior government officials in the United States and Europe. Then we'll examine yesterday's White House meeting between Biden and Japan's Prime Minister, followed by a state dinner, then today's meeting of the two leaders with President Marcos of the Philippines, where greater defense cooperation and interoperability between the allied militaries was discussed, along with 70 other agreements. Joining us is Ellis Krauss, Professor Emeritus of Japanese Politics and Policymaking at the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. He is a leading expert on Japanese politics and U.S.-Japan relations, and his books include The Rise and Fall of Japan's LDP, Political Party Organizations as Institutions, Beyond Bilateralism, U.S.-Japan Relations in the New Asia-Pacific, and Reluctant Warriors, Germany, Japan, and their U.S. Alliance Dilemma. Then finally, we'll assess the political damage to the Republicans in Arizona over the enactment of an 1864 abortion ban and wins for Democrats on the abortion issue, which will be prominent in this election year, and speak with Stephen Lemons, an independent journalist who writes about Arizona politics and crime for Phoenix Magazine and Phoenix New Times. His in-depth reporting on Arizona politics can be found at his blog, StephenLemons76.com. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Dr. Nancy O'Kale, who's President and CEO of the Center for International Policy, a scholar and advocate of human rights, justice, peace, and equity. She has over 20 years of experience working on these issues across the Middle East and North Africa region, as well as globally, and she provides policy recommendations to senior government officials in the United States and Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Nancy O'Kale.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And we're learning from various reports from the Israeli 972 magazine. There's an article in Wednesday's New York Times by David Wallace Wells titled, "The Israeli Defense Force Offensive in Gaza is an Ominous Threat of the Military Future." And you're also quoted, Nancy, in an article at Politico about the use of AI by the Israeli Defense Forces. It would seem that the recent targeting of the Hamas leader's three sons and grandchildren, all of whom were killed in a missile strike on a car they were in, was that the result of AI targeting? Do we know that?
We don't know for sure. But of course, I mean, the more technological advancement and advanced weapons that you are using, the better. Theoretically, you are able to have precision on your targets. But actually, what's happening is the opposite. And what we have been seeing is greater or larger numbers of civilian being killed. Some of that is due to the use of AI and technology. I mean, just before using the AI tools, Israel used to identify 50 targets a year. Now, with new tools like the gospel, they are identifying or claiming to be identifying 100 targets a day. So whether the three sons of Hananiah were targeted using AI, that's something that we are not able to determine, but we know for sure that using AI has given Israel the ability and the tool to have the power for further destruction and more killings.
You mention Habsorah, the gospel, which is currently being used to identify buildings and structures that the IDF claims militants operate from. There's also another system called Lavender that compiles a kill list of suspected combatants. And then there's another system called Where's Daddy, which is used to track the combatants to their homes before targeting them there. So this sounds like the barn door's open and the horse is way down the paddock, right? I mean, these are multiple systems and they're being battle tested, are they not?
Yes, they are. And the problem with the use of AI in or weaponizing AI lies like within three main issues. One, weaponizing AIs gives more power and takes away accountability, meaning that instead of following the usual chain of command on who's responsible of authorizing the bombing or the strike and how who is implementing it and what the plan is to execute it, the AI takes a big portion of this responsibility away from humans and mostly could be attributed to a mistake in coding or algorithm. And this is one of the biggest issues of using AI or weaponizing AI, that it takes away the responsibility and gives more power. The other issue is that the magnitude of the harm, as we've mentioned, the tools like Lavender or the Gospel is providing an ability to inflict more harm and target having more targets. And third, like it's something regarding the law of armed conflict where AI or technological tools cannot make decisions based on humanitarian concerns. So these are the main issues with the weaponization of technology using AI.
Well, President Biden signed an executive order back in October that provides guidelines for artificial intelligence used by the U.S. military and intelligence agencies. And it also pushed for to counter the weaponization of AI by foreign adversaries. And to that extent, I guess the U.S.-backed treaty that a number of countries have signed, there have been 50 signatories to this treaty, pushing for the responsible use of AI in warfare, many countries, UK, Germany, Ukraine, etc. I recall that a few years ago, Vladimir Putin said that whoever gets to use AI or gets to develop AI first will dominate the battlefield. And that was a while back. So, what do we know about the AI arms race?
Well, of course, I mean, it's a huge concern, and the US has a responsibility to have the leadership on mitigating this concern. As I mentioned, particularly with regards to the issue of the taking away the responsibility and accountability and providing more ability to inflict harm and killings. However, I must say that the issue really here is not just with the AI as a tool used as a weapon. It's mainly about the political will of allowing the use of weapons in wars to target adversaries without precision in an indiscriminate way that leads to the huge number of civilians being killed as we are seeing in Gaza. Even before the decision made by President Biden, I mean, a couple of years ago, there was the action plan by the Department of Defense, and it's called the Civilian Harms Mitigation Action Plan, that entails that needs to be like a pre and post strike accountability, taking like all measures possible to make sure that this is not something that is used in a way that is not careful enough and precise enough. So yes, absolutely, AI has its own problems. I mean, taking away the human judgment, I mean, that it doesn't have the same ability to make decisions based on humanitarian concerns. It takes away accountability and give more power and increase magnitude. But at the end of the day, the issue is about the political will to stop the harm, because the laws are already on the books. I mean, in the United States, that prevents, I mean, countries that are receiving arms from the US or security assistance from the US using those arms in ways that harm civilians or breach international humanitarian laws.
But is there regime, given that this US-backed treaty was signed by the United Kingdom, Germany, and Ukraine and others, 50 states have signed on to it, Russia certainly hasn't signed on, nor has China. How do you get everybody to sign on?
Again, in my opinion, the issue is not about having everybody to sign on. The issue is having the political will to enforce what's in the laws. I mean, like, the laws, international humanitarian laws, are there and they're being breached every day. I mean, whether how to get other people, other countries to sign, there are many ways, putting restrictions on the use of technology and experts and imports that would sort of contain the way and ability of those countries to continue using and innovating those technological tool, and that may be an incentive for them to sign those treaties. However, at the end of the day, that signing the treaties is not the end goal. The end goal is to stop civilian harm, and the end goal is to provide more precision in war as much as possible, and finally have the tools for accountability of those responsible for breaching those laws.
But in the meantime, Russia's destroying civilian infrastructure in Ukraine. They just destroyed the important power station. They seem to be absolutely unrestrained. And then Israel seems to be unrestrained. There's just a recent comment by the former vice presidential candidate with Hillary Clinton, Senator Tim Kaine, who said that Biden was played by Netanyahu in the early days of this war that's been going on for 6 months, more than 6 months. So at the end of the day, Nancy, are you suggesting that the U.S., in spite of signing these treaties and trying to take a stance on dealing with AI and warfare, the first thing they should be doing is pulling Israel over, because they do supply arms to Israel? And on the very day that the World Food Kitchen was targeted by the Israelis, the U.S. apparently delivered a lot of munitions to the Israelis, and they pre-positioned munitions in Israel. Massive stocks of weapons are there, which the Israelis can tap into. They obviously need some permission from the U.S. to do so, but the weapons are there, and the ammunition is there. Unfortunately, for the Ukrainians, that is not the case. The U.S. is dragging its heels on helping them. So is that what you're suggesting, Nancy, that you may have these treaties, everything's in writing, but the action is required, and here's a glaring example of what needs to be done in terms of America's supplying weapons to Israel that are being used to kill civilians?
Yes, the laws and the treaties are very important. And this is how we are even measuring progress towards a more civilized and more humane world order. However, having those on the books without the power and the political will to enforce what's in the laws is not going to prevent the extreme atrocities that we are seeing right now, whether we're seeing those in Ukraine or we're seeing them in Gaza. And the most effective way to stop this is to stop supplying the arms, at least until there is a thorough assessment of the impact of the use of those arms in the war, both again with regards to Russia. I mean, and the US is not support providing arms for Russia, but it's providing arms for Israel, and this is where the US has control, and this is where the application of aid conditionality that is stipulated by US laws, not just international humanitarian laws, should be applied.
But can you make a distinction between offensive weapons and defensive weapons? Look, for example, we're talking about Israel and the use of American arms and the use of AI in Israel to target people, and the fact that 33,000 Palestinians have been killed, 13,000 of whom are children, is appalling, and the world is appalled by this. And that's the use of offensive weapons. But on the other side, you've got Ukraine, where we're not supplying enough defensive weapons. So what's the distinction then in terms of the law that we're talking about between offensive and defensive? And how do you make these distinctions between supplying arms to Ukraine on the one hand and restricting arms to Israel on the other?
Well, when you're if you're talking technically, and if you're talking to an arms expert, they will be able to articulate the exact types of what would be considered defensive and offensive weapons. However, at the end of the day, this is about the power on who has the ability to determine that who deserves to die and who deserves to live based on designation of certain populations or certain people as being terrorists or as being suspected militants, as we have seen, and you just mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, the Lavender tool that, I mean, marked allegedly by, like, as an AI tool, marked around 37,000 Palestinians as suspected militants. The question is, who has the authority and the power to make those claims and act upon them, and upon which there's the determination of whether these are defensive or offensive weapons.
Well, given the number of humanitarian workers who have been killed by the Israelis, about 200, and I think, what is it, 95 to 100 members of the press, because the Western press can't even get in there. So the Palestinian reporters are being killed in droves. So do you think these people are being targeted by AI?
They could be. I mean, again, like, the numbers are showing that there is a greater capacity and ability of the Israeli military to target, I mean, people that they kill. AI has a role to play in that. But again, like, the issue of is not about the weapons that they use. Of course, there's a huge danger of the expanded capacity of killing, or the killing machine ability, is a huge concern. But the issue is, like, the killing of civilians, the indiscriminate attacks and bombings of civilian areas, even areas that have been designated by the Israeli military as safe zones, quote unquote.
Well, just in closing, a former Israeli military intelligence official describes these AI systems as a mass assassination factory. So this is.
And they are. And again, I mean, like, when the dust settles, even after, you like, if we cannot even stop these atrocities right now, I mean, and we should and we can by stopping arms. But even beyond that, coming to the issue of accountability and responsibility, it is much more difficult to apply this when it is conducted or implemented with technological tools or weaponized AI than the ones who are mainly following the traditional chain of commands with the authority of to target, to plan, to give the make the decision to bomb certain area or another. So at the end of the day, also, I mean, it's not just the capacity, it's the lack of accountability.
Well, Dr. Nancy O'Kell, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Nancy O'Kell, who's president and CEO of the Center for International Policy, a scholar and advocate for human rights, justice, peace, and equity. She has over 20 years of experience working on these issues across the Middle East and North Africa, as well as globally, and she provides policy recommendations to senior government officials in the United States and Europe. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining yesterday's White House meeting between President Biden and Japan's Prime Minister, followed by a state dinner, then today's meeting of the two leaders with President Marcos of the Philippines. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ellis Krauss, Professor Emeritus of Japanese Politics and Policymaking at the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. He is a leading expert on Japanese politics and U.S.-Japan relations, and his books include The Rise and Fall of Japan's LDP, Political Party Organizations as Institutions, Beyond Bilateralism, U.S.-Japan Relations in the New Asia-Pacific, and Reluctant Warriors, Germany, Japan, and their U.S. Alliance Dilemma. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ellis Krauss.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Always good to have a conversation with you, Wayne.
Well, thanks, Ellis. And of course, apropos your book, Reluctant Warriors, Germany, Japan, and their U.S. Alliance Dilemma. It doesn't seem like Japan has much of a dilemma anymore. They're sort of throwing their lot in with the United States and even with AUKUS. And there was a state visit by Japanese Prime Minister Kishida yesterday in the White House with a dinner serenaded by Paul Simon, etc. And then today, the Prime Minister Kishida and Biden are meeting with the Philippines President Marcos to talk about protecting the Philippines. So they've got a ship that's grounded on a reef that the Chinese have been harassing the Philippine crew. So there's a territorial dispute over these islands that China is claiming, and now Japan, Australia, and the Philippines have naval ships in the neighborhood trying to protect the Philippines. So a lot going on. So let's start with yesterday, Ellis. What did you make of the summit, and what came out of it?
Well, it's an extremely significant summit, I think. There apparently are something like 70 agreements that may come out of this between the two countries. And as you indicated, Japan has moved amazingly fast in the last 10 years to become a much stronger ally of the U.S. In fact, even though the Germans have joined the U.S. in Afghanistan and Bosnia and actually had some of their soldiers killed, Japan has never fired still a fired a weapon in anger in the entire post-war. Japan has actually come much further from where they started than Germany has, and Germany has been a little bit reluctant to do a lot more, a lot quicker, whereas Japan, and particularly Prime Minister Abe, previous Prime Minister Abe, and now Prime Minister Kishida, have done an amazing amount to bring Japan up to a stronger level of ally with the U.S. I should point out, however, that there are still limitations on Japan. And in some ways, speaking of Paul Simon, it's the sound of silence about certain things. And one of those that is very important is that is public opinion. The conservative elites in Japan have been moving much more rapidly than public opinion. For example, public opinion in Japan is still against helping the U.S. militarily defend Taiwan, even though it looks like Japan is moving closer and closer to perhaps doing that from an invasion by China. And it is again sending weapons to Japan, sending weapons to Ukraine, even though Japan has been one of the most strongest supporters of Ukraine. And in his address to Congress, Prime Minister Kishida once again linked Ukraine and Taiwan, saying that Taiwan may be the next Ukraine. So the government is out ahead of public opinion at this point. Kishida is raising, has promised to raise the Japanese defense budget up beyond where it has ever been before. And yet, when he tried to impose some indirect taxes in order to pay for it, even members of his own party and the public very strongly opposed it. And he had to drop the idea and postpone raising the money. So there are still things that the media is not talking about in some ways, and which involve domestic politics.
But on the other hand, Prime Minister Kishida is planning or trying to set up a meeting with the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. So what's
Yes.
that about?
Well, Japan has always preferred diplomacy to military force. It certainly doesn't want to get involved in any U.S. military activities, such as happened in Vietnam in the 60s and in the 2000s in Iraq. That's always been a no-no from the standpoint of Japanese politics and public opinion. It's about Japan defense only. That's still the public and the government's position. Nothing has changed on that. As long as Japan is threatened with aggressor, then Japan will and can respond with public support, but not for much else. So this is also the question of whether Japan will join the U.S. to defend Taiwan. Nobody knows, to be honest with you. But the Japanese are, willing to talk, and they have something estimates between 30 and 60 hostages, not hostages, but abductees that were taken from Japan, including young children, in the 1960s and 70s by North Korea. And this is a major domestic political issue. I don't think most Americans can understand how important this is in the Japanese media and domestic politics. So anything in which the prime minister can look like he's trying to get those abductees back and reducing the threat of North Korea, which the Japanese are really afraid of, just as they are afraid of China now, will help him domestically in politics.
But in terms of these agreements, and as you mentioned, there were 70 agreements, and we can talk about the Nippon Steel, the effort to buy U.S.
Oh,
steel.
that's another sound of silence.
Exactly. But in terms of defense cooperation, I mean, the U.S. and Australia and Japan, their navies are working together, and these agreements are talking about interoperability, in other words, everybody sharing the same intelligence, the same military equipment, etc., the same ammunition. That, and they're also a talk of a joint Japan joining the U.S. AUKUS defense partnership with Australia and Britain, and to work on advanced capabilities and technologies, including quantum computing, undersea hypersonic, artificial intelligence, and cyber technology. So it's pretty
Yes.
ambitious, isn't it?
It's very ambitious. And that's why this summit may well be, as I said, a pretty momentous summit, and one of the most important ever between leaders of the two countries. This is again part of where Japan is casting its lot, at least on defense and military, closer and closer to the U.S., even while trying to maintain decent economic relations with China, which is very dependent on in terms of trade. Professors Higginbotham and Samuels back in early 2000s called this the dual hedge, meaning Japan's always since then has been operating on a double insurance policy. Economically, get closer, keep close ties with China, and thus some independence from the U.S. economically. And China is very important to the U.S. to Japan economically now, while at the same time moving closer and closer to the U.S. militarily to protect itself from military aggression from China. And of course, as you know, Japan has a major dispute with China, territorial dispute with China, over the Senkaku Islands, and in fact has in fact created the equivalent of a Marine Corps in order to defend those islands. But the interoperability of the U.S. and Japan forces have been moving closer and closer and becoming more and more integrated for the last 10 years. This is not new, but it's reaching new heights. One of the agreements, I believe, that will be implemented is that the U.S. will assign a four-star general to command U.S. forces in Japan. Up to now, it's been a three-star general. But the worst part about that is that this general, whether four or three stars, has to communicate back to Hawaii to the command structure for the Indo-Pacific. And this, of course, raises all sorts of problems as well, especially in a crisis. And I think the movement will eventually be to establish a joint command structure with U.S. and Japanese forces, just as the U.S. has with South Korea now. And so this is a momentous step if the Japanese and U.S. forces can become even more integrated with a command structure based in Japan.
So why do you think, I mean, obviously this is all happening because of fears about China. And
correct.
Is the U.S. strategy then to kind of organize the neighborhood to contain China? Because nobody in the neighborhood is particularly happy with Chinese chauvinism, are they? The Filipinos particularly are being humiliated by China's aggressive displays as they claim all these atolls and islands in the South China Sea. The Vietnamese are also nervous, and most of Southeast Asia is as well. So is this a strategy here that the U.S. is, and to what extent is the neighborhood sympathetic? You're saying that the Japanese people are not that thrilled about military confrontation with China, even if their leaders are moving in that direction.
Yes. I think that, as you mentioned, that there are many countries in Southeast Asia that have finally woken up, including the U.S. and Japan, I think, belatedly. I think we could have seen this coming just a couple of years after President Xi took power. There were great hopes that she would be a liberal reformer in China, and all of these hopes have been dashed by his aggressive nationalistic behavior. Trying to get back territories that, for whatever valid or invalid reason, China keeps claiming, supposedly the Senkakus, China claims the Senkakus because some Chinese fishermen looked at the islands back in the 14th century or some ridiculous thing like that. Chinese are not even happy about Okinawa being Japanese because it used to be a tributary state of China back up until the 19th century. So this is behavior against Japan and against the Philippines and the South China Sea and many other countries. Many countries, it's not just the Philippines, have territorial claims in the South China Sea. There are some people who think that the South China Sea is going to be a greater crisis that may lead to war between countries than Taiwan, which, of course, everybody is worried about. In fact, there have been some U.S. Military officials who have predicted China will try to take over Japan by 2027. Try to take over Taiwan by 2027. But others think the South China Seas are even a greater possibility for a war. So it's many countries. And Japan is a great ally for the U.S. in this situation because a recent survey among Southeast Asian leaders, opinion leaders and elites, showed that Japan is more trusted by Southeast Asia in Southeast Asia than China or the U.S. It is the most trusted country among Southeast Asian elites. So as I mean,
but, may, but maybe not in yeah. may, maybe not in South Korea, right? There's still a lot of bitterness in South
Korea. No, the South Koreans are that's not the South China Sea, but the South Koreans are, of course, their newspapers and their opposition party, particularly the Kuomintang, are quite nationalistic still and still having. No one says they have to forget the brutality and barbarism of the Japanese military for 35 years. But they are still harping on issues about World War II, comfort women, etc. All horrible issues that Japanese military perpetuated. But as I've said in my classes here, even with Korean students, I say, look, Britain did pretty much a lot of the same stuff to the Irish for 300 years, and they can get along now. So you were occupied and you had a horrible occupation by the Japanese for 35 years. Get over it. I mean, there are now major threats between for the two countries to confront, mutual threats. And I think President Yoon understands this, but the opposition parties and the newspapers in Korea, South Korea, will use every opportunity to harp on these issues. Japan, of course, claims that all such issues were settled by the 1964 treaty between South Korea and Japan, and which in fact says that all of these issues have been settled by the treaty. But the South Koreans won't forgive or forget, at least the opposition and the newspapers won't.
Well, going from the serious to the trivial, I want to talk to you about the sort of mouthwatering dinner that they had last night at in the White House, the state visit. They served sort of American food with Japanese flavors, house-cured salmon followed by dry-aged ribeye with wasabi sauce and salted caramel pistachio cake with cherry ice cream. And the stateroom was decorated with cherry blossoms. And then Paul Simon sung and performed Graceland and Slip Sliding Away, playing his guitar. Apparently he's of Jill Biden's favorite artist. And also you had Bill and Hillary Clinton there along with Robert De Niro. So I don't know what to make of all that, but obviously
well,
they're pulling it. Sorry, go
I
ahead.
I regret to inform you that I was not invited.
Right. But I guess
but I wish I had been.
Right. Well, I'm just bringing it up because it seems like they pull out all the stops here, that they're taking it seriously, the U.S.
Yes, they are. But again, to continue the Paul Simon Sound of Silence theme, they did not. There were only oblique references to the Nippon Steel, U.S. steel acquisition, which, of course, is a major irritant at the moment, and which part of the American media is making a big deal over, and is a problem. But this summit was about defense, in my opinion, as well as things like setting up a defense industrial council for the two countries to integrate their technologies. It's about space and having a Japanese the first non-American to go to the moon with the Artemis project, and for Japan to develop a Land Rover for the lunar surface. And it's about cherry trees. I mean, in terms of the ridiculous, but beautiful. It's about Japan sending 250 substitute cherry trees for the for Washington, D.C. And so this is about friendship. It's about shoring up the alliance, most importantly, And it's about for the leaders of the two countries to make domestic political points. And Prime Minister Kishida is in the domestic political problem. And this visit will, he hopes, as many other things he's done, raise his political standing in Japan, which is quite low at the moment. That remains to be seen.
Well, Alice Krauss, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Alice Krauss, who's Professor Emeritus of Japanese Politics and Policymaking at the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. He's a leading expert on Japanese politics and U.S.-Japan relations, and his books include The Rise and Fall of Japan's LDP, Political Party Organizations as Institutions, Beyond Bilateralism, U.S.-Japan Relations in the New Asia-Pacific, and Reluctant Warriors, Germany, Japan, and their U.S. Alliance Dilemma. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing the political damage to the Republicans in Arizona over the enactment of an 1864 abortion ban and the wins for Democrats on the abortion issue, which will be prominent in this election year. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Lemons, who's an independent journalist who writes about Arizona politics and crime for the Phoenix Magazine and the Phoenix New Times. And his in-depth reporting on Arizona's politics can be found at his blog, stephenlemons76.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Lemons.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it seems that Arizona Republicans have pushed abortion now onto the center stage for this upcoming election. Do they know what they're doing, or are they driven by ideology as opposed to recognizing that they're really helping the Democrats?
Well, they're getting their just desserts. I mean, what happened is that in the last administration of Governor Doug Ducey, the legislature passed a law that made abortions legal up to 15 weeks, but they did not repeal the 1864 law. So they created this situation that they knew potentially there could be a legal challenge, and then of course Dobbs happened, and so the Arizona Supreme Court was asked to determine which of these laws took precedence. The more recent law that made abortions legal up to 15 weeks, or the 1864 law that was, you know, passed back when Arizona was a territory. And the 1864 law is pretty draconian. It's basically outlaws all abortions except for those that threaten the life of the mother. So they could have saved themselves the trouble, but now they've painted themselves into a corner, and the outrage and anger was shown yesterday on the floor of the House, where the Democrats moved to repeal the law, the 1864 law, and the Republicans, who only have a one vote majority in both chambers, the House and the Senate, moved to adjourn. So I think the Republicans, I think they don't know what to do, really, because the base of the party is fervently anti-abortion. And I think they're just fine with the 1864 law, at least. But they know it's problematic for them because that's not going to fly in a general election. The smart thing to do would be to just repeal the 1864 law, because in doing so, you would make abortions legal up to 15 weeks, which is a more, even though, you know, the pro-choice side would not like it, it would sort of take some of the fire out of the effort to put a constitutional amendment on the November ballot, which is there is a move to do that, and the movement apparently has enough signatures to get on the ballot. And right now, this situation with the Arizona Supreme Court saying that the 1864 law takes precedence is going to light a fire underneath that effort, and they're going to far surpass the number of they've already surpassed the number of signatures they need. They're going to far surpass it, and there's no doubt that it will be on the ballot, and it probably will pass if this 1864 law is still in effect. I don't know what the Republicans can come up with to try to craft some sort of solution, because the moderate solution would be to repeal the 1864 law, and I don't see the Republicans doing that. So, you know, this really is going to drive the election. I mean, it's going to fire up the Democratic base. This is the first time in I've been reporting on politics in the state for about 20 years. And I can tell you, like 10 years ago, the Republicans had a supermajority in the legislature, and they could do anything they wanted. And they can't, they don't have that now. But their politics are so extreme and so Trumpian that they cannot appeal to a more moderate electorate. And that's what we have in Arizona. The electorate has moderated over the last 10 years, and is leaning very, you could say, purple to blue. I mean, he went for Biden just barely in the last election, in the last presidential election. And I think Biden's got a good chance of taking Arizona again, especially after this, you know. So it basically advantaged Democrats on all when it comes to this state. And it could be that they flip the legislature, and, you know, it's a sea change, basically.
And Biden won by about 10,000 votes, which is 0.3%. And yesterday in the state legislature, the Democrats shouted, shame, shame, shame. And clearly you've got Carrie Lake, who has been denying the fact that she lost the elections. She had to switch her position entirely after praising the 1864 law, to then following Trump's cue that the Arizona Supreme Court had gone too far. She said that this is something that Katie Hobbs should handle. So how about that? I mean, you deny that the woman's the governor. You've been doing that for 2 years, saying you're really the governor and she's not. And then you turn around and call on her to fix your problems. I mean, that's pretty rich, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very rich. Well, Carrie Lake, I mean, she's become a weather vane lately, and in trying to moderate her, you know, political views are the ones that she espoused in the last election. The problem with Carrie Lake is, if you look over her history, she once praised Obama. She was a Democrat at one point, and then at some point she just drank the Kool-Aid and became an extreme right winger and espoused all these right wing views that now she's trying to dial back, because she knows it's not going to fly. You know, it's in a general election, like the stuff about how they put they put a stake through the heart of the McCain machine. Well, you know, I agree with that. They did do that. And the thing about John McCain's legacy in Arizona is that, even though I was not a big fan, but he was an astute politician. And, you know, during a primary, he'd run to the right, and then a general election, he would moderate. And then he also had a tremendous amount of power over the state party. And if the state party ever went off the rails and went too far right, which happened occasionally, he would come in and correct it. He had enough political influence. He could spend the money to recruit precinct committeemen and state committeemen to vote the way he wanted them to. But see, McCain's dead. OK, so there's no one like that left. I mean, there's no Goldwater, there's no McCain, there's no one to moderate the Republican Party here. And so the Republican Party has basically been turned over to this group called Turning Point. And they are a far right wing group that basically exists to make money. And they've made millions of dollars preaching to the converted and just no, so, and the faithful. So it's not that. They're not interested in appealing to moderate. They're not interested in moderates, and this is a big problem because a third of the electorate does not identify as Republican in Arizona, does not identify as Republican or Democrat. So those people, but in general, people do not want to go back to the 1864 law. You know, I mean, that's just a non-starter. So how do you appeal to the center? I mean, they're not even trying to do that. They don't care about it. And this is why they're losing elections. This is why Katie Hobbs is the governor. And God bless her. I mean, she vetoes all the crazy stuff that the Republicans pass, and they pass a lot of the crazy stuff. And you would think that, you know, with a one vote, just a one vote majority in the House and the Senate, that the Republicans would go, hey, maybe we should moderate. Maybe we should be more moderate. Maybe we should reach across the aisle, get some stuff done that's, you know, would appeal to the general. No, they don't care. They're just, it's all about the crazy base of their party. And so Hobbs, by vetoing all this these crazy bills, looks like the adult in the room. And suddenly the Democrats are in the position that the Republicans used to be in the state, and that they are representing the middle, you know, for now. I mean, that might change if they come into power, if they take the legislature back, or flip the legislature, that is. So we'll see. I mean, it could be that they go crazy on the left, you know, but for the moment, they represent the middle, you know, and that's a good place to be in Arizona politics. So I think, you know, it's Carrie Lake does not have a chance. I mean, I've seen some polls that put her up, but the reality is it's not going to fly. Ruben Gallego, who's running against her, former Marine, he was in Iraq in combat. I mean, the guy is he's going to fly, and he's going to beat her badly if she's the nominee, which it seems like she's going to be in the U.S. Senate race. So the U.S. Senate race is, I mean, the Senate seats are two. We have two Democrats holding them now. I mean, even though Sinema's bowing out, it's basically she's bowing out because she can't get elected in a primary. So I don't think this, their attempts to, all of these Republicans are trying, most of them are trying to like backpedal. And I just don't think it's going to work because the base of their party wants basically what the 1864 law is. So I don't know how they square this circle.
Well, you mentioned Ruben Gallego, who's the Democrat running, currently a congressman. I did see him on television a couple of nights ago. He wasn't that good. He used the phrase, he said that he's pro-abortion, which wasn't a very elegant way of putting it, I thought. So Kamala Harris is arriving in Arizona, in Tucson, tomorrow, Friday. Are they going to meet up? Is Ruben Gallego going to get a little coaching? What do you think? I mean, he's got a great resume.
Yeah, that's one bad appearance. And it's obviously that was not the right message, you know, so he needs some coaching there. I don't think that Kamala Harris, you know, helps in a general election here, her appearance, coming to the state, you know, but it helps with, you know, rally the troops as far as Democrats go. So that's not a bad thing necessarily. I think the, despite, you know, maybe one poor TV appearance, we're already seeing commercials for Ruben Gallego on TV here, and they're looking pretty good. And, you know, he's got some, his campaign online looks pretty good. So, I mean, I don't think Carrie Lake is, you know, just seen as generally a nut job in this state. You know, I mean, even like some Republicans can't, you know, a lot of Republicans can't stomach her. And you pointed out that Biden, you know, won about like 10,000 votes. Well, by 10,000 votes in the presidential election last time. And those votes generally came from conservative Republicans who could not stand Trump. Okay. Those are the same people who cannot stand Carrie Lake. And it's interesting because many of them are very deeply conservative, often religious, sometimes Mormons, but they cannot abide the extremism. and the insanity that comes with someone like Carrie Lake and Trump. So they're this never Trumper crowd, they're not going to vote for Carrie Lake. Okay, if they had some reasonable alternative, yes. There are a couple other people in the running in the primary. This Sheriff Mark Lamb out of Pinal County, he's pretty extreme too, but he comes across as reasonable. Okay, even though he has some skeletons that I don't think he can get past. But if they were to come up with just any other candidate that would be that could appeal to the middle, or just, you know, a kind of a brand of conservatism that would be different, kind of like what Jeff Flake represented at one time. He's also a senator from Arizona.
Jeff Flake was a Mormon and former senator, the first victim of Donald Trump, right? He was the first guy to go against Trump on the basis of his conscience. And look what happened to him.
Yeah, he basically had to fall on his sword. I mean, he knew he wasn't going to get, he had no chance in the primary, and Trump was making mincemeat out of him online. And it was so, but the irony is that Jeff Flake voted with Trump. I mean, he voted with the party like 99% of the time. I mean, it wasn't like he was some crazy left winger or something. You know, I mean, he was a truly deeply conservative man. And what he could not abide, and what many of the people who were in the Latter-day Saints church cannot abide, is the Trump brand, which is obscene and gets down in the mud and belittles people. And the way he belittled Flake, the way he belittled John McCain, it doesn't fly with a lot of these fairly conservative Republicans. So, you know, they're not gonna buy the Trump Lake Carrie Lake brand. It's not gonna work. So even if it's I don't know that it probably will be close again, but I don't see Trump winning the state, at least at this point, you know, unless but of course we're still far out, you know. It's a long way to November and a lot of things can happen. So and Biden does not have Biden is not a strong candidate for the Democrats, unfortunately. I think he's not been a bad president, but he doesn't fire up Democrats. He doesn't get them, you know, motivated. And they're they're concerned about his age, obviously. And Kamala Harris is very unpopular across the board. I mean, really. So it's not, it's, you know, she doesn't, so I, you know, the Democrats are basically, they're put in a position where they got to hope that Biden doesn't have a slip and fall, right? Because if that happens, it's all over. And Trump becomes president. But if nothing changes, then, you know, I could see Biden taking the state again. So.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us, Stephen. I appreciate it.
Sure, yeah, anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Lemons, who's an independent journalist who writes about Arizona politics and crime for Phoenix Magazine and Phoenix New Times. His in-depth reporting on Arizona politics can be found at his blog, StephenLemons76.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.